Moshe Kasher. Moshe is a stand-up comedian, writer, and actor. You may have seen him in Curb Your Enthusiasm, Shameless, and The Good Place. He's also starred in two Netflix stand-up specials. Moshe has just written a second memoir called Subculture Vulture, a memoir in six scenes. This guy has led a very action-packed life. He was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous when he was 15. He was a rave promoter, a DJ, and served as a psychedelic security guard at Burning Man. Thank you for your service. Moshe also learned American Sign Language so he could communicate with his deaf mother. His memoir could easily have been published as six separate memoirs, or memoirettes, if you will. He joins us now to talk about his wild ride of a life and why he chose not to do that.
Stand-up comedy is the way I pay my bills and my bread and butter, and it's already almost the ultimate narcissist's art form. It's just, hey, guess what I've been thinking about? But then I found memoir, and that's even more. Delve into what I've been thinking about over the course of 300 pages. So no, if I ever write a book again, I hope it's about somebody else.
Okay. Well, I don't know if I'd agree with that, but I hope you do write several more books. What do you think the six subcultures that you cover have in common?
That's a great question, and one that I was thinking about when I started the book. You know, this book is essentially a roadmap of these six universes that seem, at first glance, like they're maybe kind of disparate and don't have any connective tissue other than the literal tissue that is my body that brings them all together. They are, you know, AA and the 12 steps, Hasidic Judaism, deafness and sign language interpreting, stand-up comedy, raves, and Burning Man. This was a book that was so interesting to write because I almost didn't realize what it was about until I started approaching the end. And what I started to realize was that they go together, obviously, in my body and in my experience and in my life, but they're also this sort of roadmap of my quest to find weird people on the fringes of society. It was almost like a drug chase of trying to find outsiders that were like me, that would make me feel a little bit less different in the world. So I think that's some of the connective tissues. Each of these worlds are people that don't fit in, but do not allow that not fitting in to allow them to be outcast.
Let's rewind to 1994. You were a member of AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, and you were only 15. What do you remember most about this time in your life?
My primary memory was of walking in. I mean, and again, arrival is the wrong word because I'd already been in and out of rehab since I was about 13, almost 14, and I'd been forced into a big white van to go to 12-step meetings with the other derelicts and broken toys that I met in these after-school rehab programs I was in. So when I arrived, I had already kind of been there, but I guess I arrived mentally, arrived enough to raise my hand and say, like, I need help. But I walked into this young people's meeting at 15 years old to realize that I was the youngest person, even at the young people's meeting. That was a big issue, because my biggest hatred in the universe was adults. They were my problem. Adults were the problem. If the Oakland Public School System and the Oakland Police Department and my counselors and therapists and my mother and my behavioral intake diagnostic technicians would all just like get off my back and let me steal their money, everything would be fine. But when I walked into the room, I discovered to my horror, looking for the first time, that everybody in the room was an adult. And those are my enemies. The adults are my enemies. What they did was they would tell me what to do. They would prescribe the way that I should change. They would just tell me what to do, and that never worked. And I guess the first revelation was most of the people in the meeting, at least that night, at least at that time in history, weren't telling me what to do. They were telling me what they did. And with that little teeny inversion, I was able to get help enough to start my process.
So that teeny inversion allowed you to turn your life around. Would that be fair to say?
Yes. I would say that I turned my life around, but, you know, it's very piecemeal.
Your mother is deaf, and you learned American Sign Language so that you could communicate with her. You went on to become a sign language interpreter. What was that experience like?
You know, they're interrelated, and they're also completely separate. And I wanted to keep them separate. I desperately wanted to keep them separate because every CODA, that is child of deaf adults, has essentially, not every, but probably just about every, has essentially the same experience, which is a 15-year non-consensual sign language interpretation internship training program. That's what childhood was like. Beyond the regular experience of just being raised by my mother and loving my mom and her being a great parent, there was this secondary duty set, which was when I would walk into a hospital to a doctor's appointment that my mother had made, 9 times out of 10, we would discover that no one had bothered to get an interpreter. And if I didn't begin to interpret for that meeting, then my mother just would not get the medical help she needed, or she wouldn't get the administrative help she needed, or she just wouldn't get the information. And so I was an interpreter from my earliest memories. Then, as I started to get in trouble as a teenager, the topic of the meeting would shift to behavioral meetings about which I was the subject, and there was still no interpreter there. Now I have to interpret for a meeting about my own behavioral dysfunctions. This begins a truly delicate dance. You can't fully lie. You can't say, well, we here at the police department have brought your son in because we think he's a great guy and we just wanted to give him a gold star because my mom is an intelligent woman and would smell a rat. But you also can't give over the full unadulterated message of what a complete POS I was. So I had to kind of do an interpretive dance, like, oh, yeah, they say I have some problems, but in some ways they say I show great potential. Perhaps I'll be interviewed on Wisconsin Public Radio someday. So that was the beginning. And not just the funny parts, but there were parts of it that were really emotionally monumental to me. I always felt a fierce and immense pride to have a deaf parent, even when I was embarrassed of her voice, or, you know, would shrink in the back of the classroom when she would come in because I knew the other kids would hear the way she talked, and I had that kind of classic childhood shame of any difference. There was this other part of me that was always unbelievably proud of the woman that she was, and the fact that she never allowed the deficits that the educational system had imposed upon her to hold her back. You know, she got an associate's degree, went back to night school, and then got a bachelor's degree, and then got a master's degree. And I was at each one of those graduation ceremonies, and I was proud the way any son would be proud of their mother, but I was also proud on a different level because I knew the monumental obstacles she had had to leap in order to get those things. Well, the way that I became an actual sign language interpreter, it's a bit of a funny story.
Yeah, please share.
I was working, this would, I guess, be technically my first job in show business. I was working as a bear on Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, passing out flyers for a UC Berkeley sports memorabilia store called Bear Basics. And I was getting paid $4.25 an hour. And my mother approached me and said that they were hiring people at the community college that she had become through all of those educational triumphs. She had become the head educator for the DefCan program in at Laney Community College. And she told me that they were hiring interpreters and wondered if I would want to become a sign language interpreter. And I said, absolutely not. First of all, I'm already like headlining as this bear on Telegraph Avenue. It's very fun. I was a cigarette smoker at the time, so I would take my helmet off, my bear helmet, and I would take a smoke break, and the kids would walk by and they would go, "Mommy, why is the bear smoking?" And I would grunt, "I'm Smokey the Bear, kid. Now buzz off. This is my smoke break." I said, I have no interest in doing that. I don't want to cross-contaminate the trauma of my childhood with my employment. And then she said, they're paying $13.25 an hour. And I said, I will become a sign language interpreter. That was a lot of money at the time. And I went into that DefCan program, and I was in an interview with a woman named Catherine, who was a blind and deaf woman, who interviewed me by putting her hands on top of my hands and physically feeling my hands as I signed to assess the degree to which I could become a professional interpreter. You know, the fact that a blind and deaf woman was the head of the interpreter program at Laney College that was interviewing me is a story of like almost impossible odds emancipation that starts in the 1700s in France and goes across the Atlantic with Laurent Clerc, one of the first superstars of the deaf education system in France, coming to America and starting American Sign Language so that it could travel across the country to meet my mother in Berkeley when she finally entered a school for the deaf at age 13 and became fluent in ASL. At 13, she entered and experienced sign language for the first time and was fluent within 3 months to be able to give birth to me, to teach me to sign before I could speak, to be able to hold her hand so that she could assess my linguistic capability. It's against all odds that I was able to be there, and that is how I started my interpreting career.
Interesting. Thank you for sharing that. Were you able to channel any of your sign language experience into your stand-up comedy?
You know, when there are interpreters at a stand-up show, I would posit it's always fun. But usually when a hearing comedian has a sign language interpreter to the right of them, what they do is just make the interpreter pantomime dirty words over and over again to see. And they're usually what you, by the way, I know this is a public radio broadcast, but it's usually what you think. If you say the dirty word and you look at the interpreter interpreting it, it's going to be about the gesture that you think it is. But I have inverted it. I have had a fun experience of having an interpreter there who doesn't know I'm a coda and saying, you know, isn't it your job to also speak when I sign? And they go, I guess. And then I hand them the mic and I sign one of my dirty jokes and force them to say it out loud. Now, that's a pretty fun experience.
Yeah, that's a great story. What made you decide to pivot to a career as a comedian?
I don't know that these are decisions. I mean, yes, it was a decision for me to hear there was a rave in the desert and pack up a 1991 Ford Escort with a bunch of other rave scumbags and go see what adventures awaited me there. Yes, it was a decision to hold Catherine's hand for $13.25 an hour. But really, a lot of these things are, you know, I describe it as pinball or spiritual plinko. You know, you find yourself being slammed from thing to thing, and then all of a sudden you're 10 years into a world that means everything to you, and it's your career and your life, and you look back and go, oh, wow, I had no idea that this was where life was leading me. I mean, I didn't decide to do stand-up. I was writing long-form monologues and studying acting in college, and I didn't have anything to do, so I decided I'd go to New York City and spend a couple of weeks there. I looked up an old friend, Chelsea Peretti, who I'd gone to school with and studied improv with in Oakland, and she told me she was doing stand-up, and I didn't even know what that was. I mean, I knew what it was. I'd seen Eddie Murphy, and I used to like listening to Andrew Dice Clay in the car while my mom drove me to school because I thought it was funny that she couldn't hear the dirty nursery rhymes, you know? But I wasn't like a stand-up guy at all. It wasn't a part of my life, and she took me to a show, and I saw Patrice O'Neill and Sarah Silverman at that first show, and what they were doing was so raw and transgressive. I'd never seen anything like it. It felt like it should have been illegal. And then the next night she took me to a show where she was performing, and that was another experience of kind of wondery, because I go, well, I know her. That's a human being that I've met and interacted with, and she's funny and they're funny. And I said to her, okay, when you come to the Bay Area this August, this was in June, I'll write 5 minutes of material, and will you take me to an open mic? And she did, and I did, and we went to the open mic, and then I began this 20-year kind of odyssey that like leads me to writing this book and my first book and traveling around the world and headlining and winning an Emmy and having this life and meeting my wife and having a kid and being on this interview with you. And like, none of that feels like a choice. A lot of it feels like this sort of accidental path of destiny, which is, I think, what the book is about.
Very well said. I love that. And I love that you use spiritual plinko. That was great. Great price.
Well, that's an idea from my friend Pete Holmes, and I were talking about that. You kind of feel slapped from place to place, and then it feels, only in hindsight does it feel like it was meant to be. You know, they say in Hebrew, beshert. It's not meant to be while you're walking through it, but then you look back and you go, oh, I guess this was the only direction I was ever going.
Yeah, very well said. What do you think the next subculture is for you to be charmed by? Do you think there's one that you haven't experienced yet?
Well, I can tell you the one that I love the most, and this is really going to hit the Wisconsin crowd where it hurts, is surfing. I know you guys are a big surfing community there in Wisconsin, although they do have Great Lake surfing, I think.
Well, but yeah, anyway. Sheboygan's very popular. Sorry, yeah. I didn't mean to cut you off, Moshe, but
no,
yeah,
not at all. Is,
yeah.
I would love to surf Sheboygan. If you guys are Sheboygan surfers, if you want to take me out. But you know what's interesting about surfing for me? Which is so a departure from all of these things. All of these worlds that I operated in, with the possible exception of like Judaism and deafness, but even those to some degree, I didn't just want to like be seduced by them or, you know, be a member of them. Something happened when I joined these worlds. They've made me fall in love so hard. I wanted to own them. I didn't want to be a member of the rebellion. I wanted to be a Jedi Knight. You know what I mean? And I was able to do that because I had some skills in each of these universes. But surfing, I am very, very untalented. I am an unnatural, which is the opposite of being a natural. And usually in my life, my experience of going after things is so drug-based, you know, it's like I want to get high on the thing, that if I experience any resistance skill-wise, I just quit and don't go back. And surfing has been this seductive mistress, which is I'm bad at it, and for some reason, I keep trying. So maybe I've matured a little bit, and I don't need to get high off of the worlds I embody. Maybe I need to find out what they have to offer me instead of what I have to offer them. That funky.
Moshe Kasher is a comedian and the author of Subculture Vulture, a memoir in six scenes. You can catch Moshe performing at Comedy on State in Madison from March 14th to the 16th. Find out more about his memoir and appearance at wpr.org/beta.
Sometimes he was my boss. Sometimes I felt like his boss. Sometimes older brother, little brother, best friend, almost a boyfriend, even though he was gay and had a partner. It didn't matter. It was just these constant sort of beautifully shifting dynamics.
Coming up, author Sloane Crosley reflects on the loss of her close friend to suicide. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.